Hey everybody, welcome to our new video series, Juggernaut X. This is going to be the story of the last 10 years of Juggernaut Train Systems, which is kind of like my life story for the last 10 years. So make sure you click that little thumbs up down there, like the video, share the video, subscribe to the channel. Thanks for watching. We're about 4 months in. We've been open for 4 months. Some things are going well. You know, still pounding the pavement with the cold calling, going to football games and soccer tournaments, and just trying to meet parents and coaches and everything. We're getting a lot of students from Concordia, where Nate and I had both gone to school, because they didn't really have any strength and conditioning in place, so we're getting a lot of athletes from there. So that was a cool deal. But early in 2010 was very, very stressful. Nate and I had seen at that point that our third partner in this was not who I had thought him to be. And I think for a month or two, I'd known it in the back of my head, but didn't want to say it. And you know, when you're starting your own business, it was so all-consuming to me what we were doing. We were at the gym from 6 or 7 in the morning to 8 or 9 at night, Monday through Friday, another 6 to 10 hours on Saturdays, just taking Sundays off to pretty much hibernate for the day and store up some energy. And so this is just weighing so heavily on me, but I hadn't told it to Nate. I come to find out that Nate had felt the same way and hadn't said it to me. And we were roommates, and it was like one day we get home just exhausted, at the end of the week. And I kind of look at him and I was like, we have to get rid of him. And as soon as I said it, this weight was lifted off of me. And he said, yes, I've been thinking this for like the last 2 months. And so it was so stressful. It seemed like the biggest decision of my life, up to that point. So we go about doing this, and we had created operating agreements and all that kind of stuff, and actually, done some due diligence from a legal standpoint when we set things up. So we talked to our lawyer and figure out how we're going to do it. We called the other guy and we're like, hey, we need to meet. And I think he must have understood what was going down, because he like refused to meet with us in person. So I had to do it over the phone. But in doing that, it was very difficult to get the keys, his key back. So that night, we're like, man, we knew like he's gonna try and go to the gym and like either steal stuff or just like fuck it up or something. So we're like, we talked to and asked the police, like, hey, can you just have someone like sit here? And they're like, well, it's technically not trespassing, like, cause you don't have new, like corporate docs or anything yet. And his name's still on the lease and that kind of stuff. So they couldn't stop him from going in. So we're like, all right, we just have to sleep there. So we're sleeping in the gym, after a very, very stressful few days of deciding, to make this move and then executing it. And we're sleeping in the gym, and like 3 o'clock in the morning, mind you, so that the front door to the gym could open in either direction. So yeah, we had tried to like make this makeshift kind of barricade to the door, because like we didn't want him to come in. We didn't want to have a fight or an altercation about this. We just wanted to get through that day, change the locks, and move on with life and the business. So 3 a.m. we hear the someone trying to open the door, and it's just like, holy shit, like this is really happening. Like what we thought is really happening. And then of all, irony, he gets in and he's so pissed that we thought he was gonna try and break in, that we were there waiting. He's like, I can't believe you guys thought that I was going to break in. And it's like, well, of course we thought it. You're fucking doing it right now. You're trying to break in. That situation got diffused. Everyone went on their way. And now looking back at it, you know, for what was at the time this just weighing on my mind so heavily, you know, I couldn't sleep and stuff about the time leading up to this decision. It seems so long ago. It seems so trivial and insignificant in, you know, what we've done in the last 9 years since that happened. But at the time, it was like an all-encompassing thing. And then every day, every week that passed after that, it just seemed less like a big deal. And we, you know, realized this was the right thing. But you know, for any young business owner who might be going through like a stressful time with dealing with their business partner or something, I feel your pain. I know it feels like the biggest deal ever, but once you have it in your head, like that you're going to need to remove, you're going to have to fire someone or remove someone from a partnership. Like once that idea enters your head, it's not going to leave. So just do it, like get it done. It'll suck for, you know, a day or a week or a month or whatever, but you'll get through it. You'll move forward. So with all this this cold calling, we had this great meeting with this Fabio Villela Gigantino from Gigante Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and he had started coming in, and I was, you know, trained him for a week or two, just for free, just to kind of prove my value to him, and he was loving the training, so he started bringing a couple more jiu-jitsu with him, and Fabio was a brown belt at the time, and he brought a couple black belts, Ulpiano Malachias, Alexandre Santos, both Gracie Baja guys, and they're training hard and loving it. Mikey Gomez, who was a GB black belt and fighting MMA, I think in either maybe Strikeforce or Elite XC at the time. There's, you know, so many different things going on MMA wise in that early 2010 kind of time, but we really started to grow in jiu-jitsu. So going from this one, you know, this cold call and showing up at a jiu-jitsu school and this one guy coming in, now I've got four black belts, and then it became, you know, six black belts, and then it's Kyron Gracie, Felipe de la Monica, you know, all these guys from all the Gracie Baja schools all around Orange County and Southern California, because they had just been, you know, GB was bringing guys over from Brazil as they were really expanding their schools to essentially one in every city in Orange County, and all the professors came to train with me, and that they're like, oh, it's the juggernaut, oh, the, you know, we're gonna smash everybody, and I'd go to these jiu-jitsu tournaments, and people knew me at the jiu-jitsu tournaments, they knew me as the juggernaut, which I still am a little bit undecided if that's just the Brazilian, you know, Portuguese accent saying juggernaut, leaving the T off, or if they would see the shirt with the deadlifter at the T as the T and they wouldn't understand that that was supposed to be a T. I'll have to ask them now because I'm still not 100% sure. But it became this great thing, and then I'm coaching Romulo Bajau and, you know, Felipe Pena, Victor Estima, Mario Reyes, people traveling from Brazil, Roberto Alencar, Tusa, and, you know, gained this really big reputation in it. And, you know, now as I'm doing jiu-jitsu myself, like, it's crazy for me to look back at that time and think like, wow, you know, I got such a fortunate opportunity to create relationships with all these guys, and they're busting their ass, training hard. And that was like a really, really fun group to train. I have a lot of good memories looking back with those guys. And it's, you know, some of them now almost all of them have moved kind of away from the competitive stage of their career, and they're all running schools and being successful. Several of them moved out to Texas to expand Gracie Baja out there. But it's great when I get to see them at tournaments and always, you know, fun memories about all the hard training that they used to do, and they really did bust their ass. Those guys were training so incredibly hard.
So rip it up, Piano. There you go, good. Got Fabio Vieira, World Jiu-Jitsu Champion, Piano Pro MMA Fighter, the 5-minute conditioning circuit, juggernaut. This is the second 5 minutes of their 10-minute round.
It's mind-blowing for me to think back and think about what they were doing, and I would do a lot of the training differently, but to realize how hard they were training jiu-jitsu and then come and train with me like that, those dudes were some real warriors. Club sports is the other area where we really began to grow, and this was you know, some through cold calling and some through just some fortunate relationships. As I mentioned, we were training a lot of athletes from Concordia, Nate's my alma mater, and the one team that like really kind of latched onto it was men's water polo. And not only did the team train, but also all of the coaches came and trained. And that's actually how it kind of started, is the water polo team was in season, so they didn't want to start the new training then, but the coaches asked like, hey, can we come train too? And I'm like, yeah, no problem. So I ended up becoming like great friends with these guys. And Steve Carrera, the head coach, connected us with another water polo coach named Peter Asik. Through Peter, we got, you know, more water polo clients. And then like the sister of one of his players, she played club volleyball. So then we got in with the volleyball and just really growing with club sports. And that was a great market for us. And I think a great lesson too, that through forming this good relationship with Steve, and then through Peter, and then with this family, the Hucos, that we met through Peter, and he had coached the older brother and now the younger brother in water polo, and then we were working with the sister in volleyball. Through, you know, 2 or 3 degrees of separation led us to like 250 clients. So that was something that really told me, like, you know, every single relationship you have as a small business owner can be that, you know, could potentially be this windfall of new clients and great word of mouth and stuff. So you need to treat every client, you know, with this great attention and great respect, because they are so valuable. So if you make their experience the best possible, it's only going to help you grow that name. So that was a cool time, you know, getting involved again in more sports that I didn't have a lot of background in, with water polo and volleyball, but got to meet a ton of great people, help athletes go, you know, to all sorts of big schools on athletic scholarships, UCLA, USC, Pepperdine, a lot of fun stuff with that, University of Washington, and just get, you know, exposed to kind of different sport cultures, because I was a football guy and a track guy, and now we're getting in with jiu-jitsu and getting to do stuff with those people, and you know, club volleyball culture is its whole own world, and water polo is its whole own world. So that was a lot of fun. A lot of the training of these water polo and volleyball athletes had become based around this program that I wrote probably in early 2010, very early 2010. You know, now that I really think about it, I'd started developing a program that was in part influenced by 531, by Jim Wendler. In part influenced by the training of a power lifter, the original power builder, Doug Young, and some articles that I'd read about him. And Doug Young, you know, would do an AMRAP set basically to finish each of his, you know, primary exercises. And if he was doing 4 sets of 4, on that 4th set, he would do as many reps as he can, and every rep he did more than 4 would dictate how much weight he increased for the next workout. So if he did, you know, 7 reps, 3 extra reps over 4, then he would bump it up 15 pounds for the next workout. So yeah, I kind of took the ideas from Wendler of this 3 weeks up, 1 week down, and AMRAP work, and then the idea from Doug Young of letting those AMRAPs dictate how quickly or slowly you progress the weights. And then, you know, I say some block periodization ideas, and that's like what it says in the original book, but I don't think I really understood what that was at the time. So in my mind, I may have been influenced by it, but it was more just, you know, using the language of accumulation, intensification, realization. So we were using this program with a ton of the clients. And at the time I was still throwing the shot put. You know, I was still competing at track. Unfortunately, you know, pretty shortly after I graduated college, Coach Blue, who, you know, coached me in high school, coached me in college, was really like this kind of grandfather like figure to me, you know, passed away from cancer. So I wanted to continue doing track, but didn't exactly have a coach anymore. So I was doing the best I can and threw pretty far, but, you know, between not having a coach and opening up this new business, working 60, 70 hours a week, it had come time for me to end that Olympic dream in the shot put. So I had this program, the Juggernaut Method, that I'd written, though, I mean, we just only called it that internally, I guess, at the time, and had been using it with a lot of success with these high school and college athletes, and, you know, especially sports like volleyball and water polo, where they hadn't had much exposure to lifting before. They're getting, you know, like doubling their squat in the first two months with it. So I'm like, this is pretty cool. And I said, I did my last track meet, I think in late May, early June 2010. And I said, I'm going to do a powerlifting meet. And I was sponsored by Elite FTS at the time for the shot put. So that was kind of a unique thing. So I figured, well, I'm already strong, you know, so let's do a powerlifting meet and see what this is all about. And in my mind, I said, I'm going to do this program that I wrote. I'm going to do the Juggernaut Method. And the world of internet fitness, and even more so internet powerlifting, was so different in 2010 compared to what it is in 2019. You know, there wasn't dozens or hundreds of YouTube channels dedicated to this and Instagram pages dedicated to it, and, you know, all kinds of different people with programs that they're selling and ebooks and all that kind of stuff. It was like Elite FTS, and there was 531, and that was like the one successful ebook about powerlifting training. So I just figured, like, you know, I can do that. I can turn this into a book and sell it. And, you know, it's been working for all these athletes at the gym, and it's going to work for me. Yeah, July 2010, I start training on the Juggernaut Method, the original Juggernaut Method, exactly as written. I remember the first day, five sets of 10 at 405 in the squat, and the last set's supposed to be an AMRAP, the fifth set. And I think maybe I did 11, but it was just, you know, a pump like I had never felt in my life before. And I'm like, man, this is what I've been making people do. This is pretty rough. But, you know, get through it and go train with that July, August, September, October. I finish it up and I'm ready. I'm signed up for a powerlifting meet. I'd never even been to a powerlifting meet before. And this was the first ever USPA meet. Steve Dennison, the president of the USPA, had just left the USPF. I think this meet, even when I signed up for it, was a USPF meet, but it turned into USPA meet. So it was the Central California Championship, Central California Open, something like that, San Luis Obispo High School. So I drive up there, you know, I don't know what to expect. Like, I've seen some videos of powerlifting competition on Elite FTS, but that was, you know, all multiply lifting. This is to the point that I didn't know what I was getting into. When I went to buy a singlet, I'm talking to the customer service person from Elite FTS on the phone, Rhonda, and she's like, oh, you need a singlet for your meet, right? And I was like, yeah. I said, can you send me this one? I said, metal ace squatter. And she's like, oh, aren't you doing the competition raw? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, well, that's a squat suit. And I didn't really know what that was or know what that meant. I just figured, I saw all of these things that to me looked like singlets on the page. And I was like, well, this one's $50 and this one's $250. I clearly want the $250 one. That one must be better. But she directed me, thankfully, towards just the regular singlet. And I got that and went to the meet. And I go into this meet knowing, if you don't lift great, the whole idea of selling this program as an ebook was a waste. Like, you have to lift great. That's what's going to validate it and make it go. So in the months leading up to it, I'd been writing all the other, you know, parts of the book. Like, we had the nuts and bolts of the program, but writing everything else around it. And I went into this meet just thinking, you know, you have to lift great, or the last 4 months were a waste. Like, don't even bother trying to sell this book if you don't lift great. If you don't squat 800, that was the number. So I show up in my Nike Freeze. They're talking about rack heights and openers and all this stuff, and I'm like, I don't know what any of this means. I do remember when getting bench rack heights, a very portly, rotund gentleman asking me what I was opening at, and I said 725, and he looked at me, he's like, oh, me too, in the bench, and like tried to tried to like big time me and kind of like intimidate me or something. He went on to bomb out, of course. And there's a guy, you know, bench in a shirt, bench only guy in a shirt, and he bombed out. But that was kind of a funny experience. So I'm there and I'm just kind of, you know, doing my thing. There was no YouTube videos to watch about guide to your first powerlifting meet or anything like that. I just showed up and I was like, you know, how long do you think like it'll take before I can squat? And ask some people, and they're like, oh, you probably have an hour. I was like, all right, I'll start warming up now. And this guy sees me wrapping my knees, and I'd wrap my knees twice in training, just done it myself, and there wasn't YouTube videos about this at the time. So I do it, and the guy kind of stops me. He's like, hey, you want some help with that? And I said, yeah, you know, that'd be great. And he asked me, well, do you have a certain way that you want it done? And I told him, I said, wrap it the way that's going to make me squat the most. And he really helped me out. A lifter named Alan Best is a really good single ply lifter in the USPA, or the USPF and the USPA. So thank you to him. So I went in, squatted 725 on the opener, jumped to 362 and a half kilos, 799.9, let's call it 800, and miss it on the second attempt. So I'm walking back and all I'm thinking was, if you don't squat 800, you don't have a book to sell. The last 4 months of training were a waste. Get up there, third attempt, make 800. Go 3 for 3 in the bench 462, 210 kilos. Then to the deadlift. I walk up to the deadlift with just my socks on. And then like, as I'm walking to the bar, they're like, hey, you gotta have a sole on that. So I put my Nike Freeze back on, the squishy, like not just Nike Freeze, like the squishiest pair of Nike Freeze possible. So real quick, put my shoes on, ended up pulling 700 past my last attempt. You know, I guess at the time it was like every USPA record probably, because it was the first meet. So that was cool. And like, that was powerlifting. I walked away from it with this 1962 total. I think there was a lot of, you know, raw powerlifting was so much smaller then. So that was like the number three total in the world, or number three total in the US. I think tied for second, maybe Ernie Littlebridge Sr. and I think we're tied with the exact same total. Number two total in the US at 308. So crazy to think now that there's, you know, 181s out totaling that, but at the time it was a really big deal. And I knew now, like, all right, I did what I came to do. I said, now there might be some people who actually want to buy this book. So kept working on the book, and ended up releasing it, I think, like, you know, Black Friday or right around there. So, you know, a month or so after the meet. And, you know, as I look back at the last 10 years of all the things that have really changed the trajectory of Juggernaut in my life, and that's, you know, kind of the story of Juggernaut is my life story for the last 10 years. That is probably, you know, the biggest moment is deciding, you know, you're gonna write a book, you know, an ebook, not a real book, but you're gonna write a book. And you're gonna, you know, try and sell it. And then, you know, it turned out that people actually bought it and really liked it. And that was, I think, the, you know, I certainly didn't realize it at the time, but looking back is one of the biggest moments that has brought me to where I am now.